Beat it, Bo, while your feet are mates. We'll see the whole United States. With a smoke and a pal and a fire at night. Up again in the morning bright, with nothing but road and sky in sight. And nothing to do but go. Beat it, Bo, while the walking's good. The birds on the wire are still sawing wood. If today ain't the best for you and me, there's always tomorrow that's come and see, and the day after that that's going to be. And nothing to do but go. Son with the nervous feet, I never was meant for a steady beat. I've had many a job for a little spell, I've been on the bum and I've hit it swell. But there's only one road to fare thee well, and nothing to do but go. Welcome to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. I showed up here at the studio without the regular theme music, which seemed to have been misplaced. Everything can't work the way it's supposed to be. So that opening came from the recording, the Red House recording called Loafer's Glory, Songs and Stories. In consequence of which, of course, I didn't get to do the poem I had planned on doing, as I like to insert poems at the beginnings of these affairs. The poem I had intended now was The Rebel Toast by Joe Hill, which I will rend for you now. The Rebel Toast. If freedom's road seems rough and hard and strewn with rocks and thorns, then put your wooden shoes on pard, and you won't hurt your corns. To organize and teach, no doubt, is very good, that's true. But still, we can't succeed without the good old wooden shoe. Wooden shoe diplomacy, you know, the French workers at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when they got aggravated at the boss, all they could afford was wooden shoes, clogs, called sabots, and they would take one off and throw it into the machine and jam the gears, hence sabotage. That's why on our union, the Industrial Workers of the World, you see on some of the buttons, some of the posters, a little wooden shoe. Sabotage, the conscious withdrawal of efficiency, as it was defined. Well, yeah, so this is me, you Utah Phillips, the Golden Voice, the Great Southwest, with Steve Baker. That was the Borsdorfs, as I always like to tell you, playing that theme music. And we are in the studios of KVMR. Community radio. Radio, the TV with the no-inch screen. It's radio. The marvel of radio, as my wife Joanna, who's in the studio with us today, puts it, is that radio gives you the opportunity to create your own vision. And of course, we're here in downtown metropolitan Nevada City. Been a little over 10 years since I moved from Spokane, Washington down here. Why move from Spokane, Washington? Well, Spokane, Washington is kind of like Denny's. It's not a place you go to. It's a place you end up. I have a friend, a good friend, Robbie Osman, who said, you know, he listened to these shows. He said, you know, I really like it when you pick up your guitar and you play. And just tell stories. So I haven't brought any recorded material with me today, but I just brought my guitar and a mouthful of words, which I'm going to launch into, and then we'll see how far we get. Makes it really easy on the engineer, you know. All right, start out with this. Now, this is a quiz. I want you to tell me who it was who said this. Of course, I'm going to tell you anyway, but see if you can guess who it was who said this. The only form of labor which gives the working man a title to its fruits is that which a man exercises as his own master, by which some new form or new value is produced. It violates right order whenever capital so employs the working or wage-earning class as to divert business and economic activity entirely to its own arbitrary will and advantage without any regard to the human dignity of the worker, the social character of the economic life, social justice, and the common good. Now, was that Eugene Debs? Was that Big Bill Haywood? Was that Karl Marx? Nope. That was Pope Pius XI in a papal encyclical on labor in the last quarter of the last century. Story that grows out of that papal encyclical I got from old Charlie Davis, the sort of the informal town historian of Oswego, New York. And Charlie Davis has passed away now, but he got me around that town pretty good. I used to play at a club there called the Water Street down by the river that flows into Lake Ontario. And I'd go hang out with Charlie Davis because I was curious about the town. He said that encyclical came out, and of course the bishopric for that area covered parts of Canada, the lake, and then into upstate New York. The bishop didn't want any of his priests to follow up on that encyclical. I guess he was a bought man, but he didn't want anybody to act upon that. Well, the priest down there in Oswego, New York, named Father Barry, and he took it dead seriously. But then he could see what was happening in the factory system in the towns around him. Well, Father Barry knew that the glassblowers over at Potsdam, New York, were trying to organize. And it was a time when it was very, very difficult to organize. There wasn't much of a labor movement then. So he arranged for them to be able to meet in a secluded valley outside Potsdam where they begin could plan their tactics. Well, Father Barry got a letter one day. A fellow wrote him and said, I understand that the glassblowers of Potsdam, New York, are beginning to organize and that you have been involved in that. I would like to have the opportunity to meet with them. So Father Barry wrote back and said, yes, come ahead. Fella got off of the train up there, and Father Barry took him to a secret meeting out in that little valley. Fella came back, got on the train, and then he left. Now it was about, sometime later that Father Barry got a letter from that fella. Said, you have, by this experience, given me a whole new way to organize American workers. And it was signed Samuel Gompers, who, of course, was the founder of the American Federation of Labor. Now, I asked Charlie Davis, I said, where can I see that letter? He said, well, there was a nun who cared for Father Barry in his declining years, felt that when he died, everything that he'd ever wanted published was already in print, so she took everything that was left and put it in a tin box and was buried with him. So now, if you are to believe Charlie Davis, the beginning of the American Federation of Labor is in a tin box at the foot of Father Barry's cross in Oswego, New York. Song from T-Bone Slim. Giant logger Valentin Ruda, a Finnish immigrant, but went by the name of T-Bone Slim, worked all through the forest, organized for the IWW. Up into the 1930s, tugboat captain there in Long Island Sound. They tell me, people who knew him, that as an old man, he died like Lee Poe, roaring drunk, trying to embrace the reflection of the moon on the water. They go wild, simply wild over me, although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me, and he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card, and he went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me, and I plainly saw we never could agree. a soil at the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. Well, then the jailer, he went wild over me. Oh, he locked me up and threw away the key. It seemed to be the rage to keep me in a cage, and he went wild, simply wild over me. Now they go wild, simply wild over me. I'm referring to the bedbug and the flea. Oh, they murmur in my sleep, they disturb my slumber deep. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, will the roses grow wild over me? Oh, when I've gone into the land that is to be. Oh, when my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, then God, he went wild over me. Oh, when I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. Oh, when the angels heard me yell, oh, they shot me down to hell. But they went wild, simply wild over me. T-Bone Slim. Juice is stranger than friction. It's a book he wrote of his sayings, aphorisms, and polemics and observations. A rare book, but it's been republished by Charles Kerr. You can order it through your local bookstore. Good reading for the millions. Well, of course, that story is about the birth of the American Federation of Labor, which was the Federation of Craft Unions. You're right on that cusp where the workers were moving into the factory system and giving up their tools, you understand, the tools of their craft, the tools of their trade, which in a mechanized situation were owned by the bosses, were owned by the corporations. And it was their last ditch to hang on to their craft identity that grew into craft unionism, which meant that you could have four or five, maybe 20 bargaining units on the same job. Each union with its own contract, each union with its own settlement, with its own bargaining, led to a lot of confusion. Well, there was another idea being born right before the turn of the century. And that was the idea of industrial unionism. Big Bill Haywood, head of the Western Federation of Miners, an organizer for them. And Bill, of course, it was who saw the ore coming up out of a struck mine, the scabs pulling the ore out, but then the union railroaded carrying it to the union mill. And Bill said, that's union scabbing. Now, what would it be like if everybody who worked in the metal mine industry belonged to the same union? It's like if everybody who worked for the airline belonged to the same union. Hey, you might wind up owning an airline. Ha ha, think about it. Well, of course, they were at loggerheads. You know, Sam Gomper said, craft unionism pure and simple. Bill Haywood said, we need to take control of the means of our production. We need to produce for use instead of profit. We need to create abundance for workers and nothing for parasites. Yeah, I guess Dr. Greenway described the industrial workers of the world, Haywood's union, as a banzai charge on capitalism. Was, still is. Of course, now, Bill Haywood got his industrial experience working in the mines in Butte, organizing there. I was up there singing at Butte Miners Hall No. 1. It was an organizing drive for the union. And we all went down to the bar there in town, the last of Fintown that hadn't been mined out, the Helsinki bar. And we were drinking as the people we had been singing to pushed the tables together and then debated which one was going to have the privilege of signing up first, why our union hadn't been in that town for 50 years. And they were ready. Oh, they were ready. Well, Viola, who ran the place, she came to me and said, you boys are wobblies. I said, yes, we are. She said, you know, there's a story you ought to hear. So she put a closed sign on the door, drove off. 15 minutes later, she came back with a very, very, very old, tiny, tiny old lady. Introduced her as Gilda Hakkinen, wife of a Finnish immigrant who had worked in the mines. And Viola said, this woman has a story you need to know, and you sit down, and she'll drink with you, but you don't provoke her. She'll tell you when she's ready. Well, we started knocking back that harsh Finlandia vodka, and she began to talk. She said, oh, yeah, Big Bill Haywood. My mother talked about him. He worked here in this town. He dehorned. I said, what is that, Mrs. Hawk? And he said, well, dehorning is, you wanted the miners to go to a union meeting, but when they were off shift, they go to the bars, they go to the brothels. So what you did was while they were working underground, you took axe handles and went to those places and made sure they were closed. Of course, you got beaten up a lot. And Bill at that time was married to Nevada Jane, she said. Nevada Jane was crippled in a fall from her horse, and she could never walk again. And so Bill would carry her down from the little house they lived in and set her at the train station where she would organize the women of Butte. And while he was in town doing that dehorning, and of course, well bloodied, he would show up at the end of the day, pick Nevada Jane up in his arms, hang a kid off of each shoulder. He had the two of them. They could be seen in the failing light walking off to that little house up the hill. A little bit different image of the Bill Haywood I heard about when I was a kid, who was rough and tough and quick with his fists and quick with a gun. A little softer idea. Of course, it was Kate Wolf, my old friend, who found that in a journal of mine, and she demanded that I turn it into a song. So I did. Are the linens turned down in folds of glowing white? Are you lying there alone again tonight? He's marching again through the cold November rain. You know he'll come back home, Nevada Jane. And when he stumbles in with blood upon his shirt, washing up alone just to hide the hurt, he'll lie down by your side and wake you with your name. You'll hold him in your arms, Nevada Jane. Have you seen the way he holds her as though she was a bride? Children riding on the shoulders strong and wide. She never thought to scold him or even to complain. And Big Bill always loved Nevada Jane. Nevada Jane went riding, her pony took a fall. The doctors said she never could walk again at all. But Bill could lightly lift her, the big hands rough and plain, would gently carry home Nevada Jane. The storms of Colorado, they rained for 10 long years. The mines of old Montana were filled with blood and tears. California, Arizona, yeah, and Utah heard the name of the man who always loved Nevada Jane. And now the ranks are scattered like leaves upon the breeze, and with them go the memories of harder times than these. But some things never change, they always stay the same, just like the way Bill loved Nevada Jane. Have you seen the way he holds her as though she was a bride? Children riding on the shoulders strong and wide. She never thought to scold him or even to complain. And Big Bill always loved Nevada Jane. Yeah, Big Bill always loved Nevada Jane. You'll notice a few minor imperfections in the rendition of that particular song, which I love. For instance, I sing it with my eyes closed. It means I bang my nose into the microphone. And also, if I don't sing these songs often enough, they fade from my mind. But like old Art Theme says, when your memory goes, forget it. Nevada Jane. I'm glad I found these stories. I certainly wish that I'd grown up with them. I wish that all of our kids had grown up with these kinds of stories. You know, if we had grown up with these things, we'd be a whole lot more pissed off than we are. I mean, we know exactly who to be pissed off at, and that's a fact. Well, now, Bill Haywood, Big Bill, he went on to become one of the founders of the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wildleys, along with Mother Jones, the miner's mother, Eugene V. Debs, the founder of the Socialist Party of America, and Daniel DeLeon, so many others, Father Haggerty, Lucy Parsons, the widow of Albert Parsons, from the Haymarket, the Haymarket Martyrs, and the fight for the 8-hour day. They are a high-powered bunch. Well, of course, the idea of industrial unionism was so threatening to the bosses, so threatening to this emerging corporate industrial base, that it was attacked with all vigor. I mean, to the point where the American Federation of Labor was being supported by the bosses as a more mild alternative to this radical idea of industrial unionism, which was threatened to topple the whole economic structure of capitalism. Well, of course, under that vicious assault, halls were busted up, leaders were jailed. Terrible strikes, the Patterson strike, the Lawrence Silk strike, many of them, the Everett Massacre, Centralia, Washington, all those stories that never made it into the history books, that I had to sit at the knees of my elders, seek them out, and say, tell me those stories. There was a time when the union, the headquarters in Chicago, was so penurious that the sole source of support for the main office was Big Bill Haywood on his speaking tours. Bill was a powerful speaker, but now this was the time of the First World War when the Espionage Act had been passed, and anybody who sent through the mail or uttered anything that was regarded as seditious could be jailed or the mail could be seized. They would be otherwise investigated. Bill Haywood had already been on trial there in Cook County, and the word went out through the court on his speaking tour that if Bill Haywood said anything seditious, he was to be arrested immediately. Well, of course, now Bill played that like a harp. He was speaking in Milwaukee, room full of workers and cops all around the three walls, just waiting for him to say something seditious. Well, he stood up there in an enormous white cowboy hat, and he said, "I'm a two-gun man from the West." Well, bam, the cops started down the front aisle just as they got to the front. He reached one hand to one vest pocket, pull out his red card on the Industrial Workers of the World, reach into the other pocket and pull out his membership card in the Socialist Party of America. A two-gun man from the West. Well, of course, the audience dissolved into hysteria and laughter and embarrassed the cops right out of there. Bill, of course, was of failing health. He was older. He was traveling too much. He was overweight. He had to get back to Chicago and didn't have any money. He was walking down the street, and he saw a sign that said, it was a construction site, said, "Help Wanted." It was American Federation, an AFL site. So Bill went in there to get a job, you know, day labor, doing anything. The foreman on the job recognized him right away. Hell, his face had been in every paper in the country for a number of years. And he decided to have a little fun at Bill's expense. And Bill said, "I need a job." He said, "Well, we got a job here, although you look a little too old to do this kind of work." Bill said, "Hell, I worked under mine. I worked as a cowboy. I've done hard work all my life. Now, give me that job." Well, the foreman said, "With this job, you got to take apprenticeship examination." Bill said, "Well, give it to me." Well, he said, "You got to know the difference between a joist and a girder." Bill said, "Hell, everybody knows that." Fellow said, "Yeah, but do you?" Bill Haywood said, "Yeah, Joyce wrote Ulysses and Goethe wrote Faust. Now give me the job." Joe Hill's best song, one of Bill Haywood's favorite songs about industrial unionism. "Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then come join the grand industrial band. Ah, would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do your share, lend a hand. For there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. And that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack that's away in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? But there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. And that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. And now if you like sluggers to beat in your head, don't organize all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. And that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. So come all ye workers from every land, and come join the grand industrial band. And then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand. For there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. And that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Power in the union. Well, that was an idea that swept the country, an idea of industrial unionism. Badly attacked and tried to wipe it out when the CIL was founded in 1935, came close to succeeding during the McCarthy years and the beginning of the Cold War. But it's an idea whose time has come again. Bill Haywood said at the founding convention of the IWFW in 1905, he said, world labor needs a world union. Well, capitalism is globalized, isn't it? Has no use for nationalism except to convince American auto workers that Japanese and Mexican auto workers are their enemy. Oh, divide the working class, keep it eating itself. No, world labor needs a world union, and we finally have the tools to do that, don't we? The rapid means of communication, all the tools the bosses have are available to us to begin to build that one big union of all skilled, semi-skilled, and unskilled workers into the OBU. There I go preaching again. But what the hell? It's my radio show, and it's the people's airwaves, and I do what I damn well please. I kind of like this, too, you know. Now I'm not queuing up records or I'm just palavering. Well, now, Tom Scribner was one of those wobbly organizers, started in the forest in 1916. What a great teacher to me. Tom, well, he was organizing unions of the unemployed in the forest up till 1957. Every place he went, he took a little printing machine with him because he knew that knowledge was power. And he ran off underground papers in the logging camps, the Redwood Ripsaw Review, the Lumberjack News. Well, he was a Red, so he never got a pension or Social Security. He lived in a flop house called the St. George Hotel, Santa Cruz. He played the musical saw on the streets. And some of you around those parts remember him, tiny little old man with sleeve garters and a black bowler hat and that musical saw. Oh, yeah. Many, many times I've walked down those dark, dank corridors of the St. George Hotel, smelling of urine and tea bags, the halls, I mean, up to that old man's door. Big poster on the door of him hunched over the musical saw, and underneath in bold black letters it said, Tom Scribner, musician and revolutionary. Ha! Somebody who knows who he is. Hot dog, you cleave to that, you cleave to that. Well, now, he told me, Tom Scribner, one time, that he was the world's greatest living wobbly. That's what we call industrial workers of the world, wobblies. I said, how can you say that? San Francisco Phil Melman, who did time for this union, 1920 to 25 in San Quentin, as a political prisoner, is still alive. Fred Thompson, his cellmate, is still editing The Industrial Worker in Chicago. How can you tell me you're the world's greatest living wobbly? Well, Tom said, when they busted up this union, the Palmer Raids, 1919 or so, I wanted to let those people know that my union was my life, it was my religion, it was my family, it was my only reason to go on working and struggling. The way I let them know it was I caught a freight train from Sandpoint, Idaho, down to Spokane, Washington, Spookaloo. Went to a Jagger, what they call a tattoo artist, they call them dermographers today. Went to a Jagger, and I had him give me a tattoo on the left cheek of my butt, a likeness of Big Bill Haywood himself, the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World. And on the other cheek, I had him tattoo the universal label of the IWW with a 3 stars organization, education, emancipation, right there on the right cheek. Well, how do you know if this man speaks the truth? You know, what do you call him, a liar? Do you divest him of his accoutrements? No, he was old. You wait. Well, Tom Scribner liked to drink a bit. He drank in a bar across the street from the St. George, and there was always some young fella to help him back home, you know, back to his room. And one night it was my turn, and oh, that night Tom Scribner did not get plastered. He got stuccoed. Got him back up to his room. Just the flashing of the light on the neon sign out in front advertising the hotel. And I thought, on behalf of my union, because rumors were rife through the union, on behalf of my union, that we would find out whether this rumor was true or not. Dropped his trowel. And there, withered flanks, and there on the left one, was a faint outline of someone who could have been Big Bill William D. Haywood, the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World. And then the other was a sort of a Dolly-esque, droopy version of the universal label of the Industrial Workers of the World, the 3 stars organization, education, emancipation. Of course, what convinced me that he was the world's greatest wobbly was the picture of Sam Gompers in between them. Song that Tom loved, and he loved to sing this, and you're going to sing this too, as loud as we can. We've sung this before. We'll sing it again to the old hymn tune of What a Friend We Have in Jesus. The Wobbly stole the hymn tunes because they were pretty and everybody knew them, and then changed the words so they made more sense. Song, dump the bosses off your back, and that's your refrain. And I can hear him in his creaky, cranky old voice saying, boss, isn't that double S-O-B spelled backwards? And don't you wish you'd thought of that? Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Boob, why don't you buck like thunder and dump the bosses off your back? All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back. Bah, bah, bah. Now, doesn't that make you feel good? Now, Steve, as we're doing this, seat of the pants radio, folks, if we're doing this, I don't know what the clock, I have no clock here, so how close to the intermission are we getting?
I think we all need to hit the bathroom now, don't we?
Especially, oh, okay, all right, we'll do an intermission to piss. You all go pee off the back porch, and we'll gather our thoughts and play Kenny Hall doing, I think, the Happy Neighbor Club here and have a little respite.
You're listening to Loafer's Glory with Utah Phillips, buck naked in the studio without a recording in sight, except this one in the background right now. You know, to get a Loafer's Glory newsletter, you can call 800-989-3825. That number again, 800-989-DUCK. Or you can write Utah at Box 1235, Nevada City, California, the zip code 95959. Thanks to stations like WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, and KMUN in Astoria, Oregon, for carrying Loafer's Glory. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you.
we're back again after listening to Blind Kenny Hall, a wonderful, wonderful human being. I don't know if you've seen Kenny Hall's new mandolin. Then neither is he. I love that man. I love that man. Now, back on track here. I was traveling through Illinois. I was invited to go and participate in a memorial in a little town called Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery at Mount Olive, Illinois? Well, I'll give you a hint. It's a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Does that tell you who it was? Well, it was Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones. It's hard for the human mind to imagine a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. When Mother Jones was born, there were people alive who remembered the Revolutionary War, and she died on the eve of the New Deal. 1830 to 1930, lived 100 years. She was the miner's friend, mainly, as she's known as, she was the miner's friend, the miner's mother. In those coal towns down in West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, the men were organizing the underground miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and leading them over the snow-covered game trails down into the hollers. Armed only with mops and brooms, drove the scabs out of the coal pits. She was pure hell. Now, Mother Jones, she was not an organizer. She was an agitator, which meant that sometimes the organizers hated her as much as the bosses. She was a wild card on everybody's deck, and nobody knew how she was going to deal herself. One time she was there in Ludlow, Colorado. It's a terrible, terrible strike. Now, the state had mandated the eight-hour day, made it a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia and owned the mines. Well, they were meeting in the Union Hall. Mother Jones was there. The governor had promised not to send in the militia, but he lied, and he did. Soon as the word had reached the Union Hall that the militia had entered the coal fields, Mother Jones jumped up and screamed, "Let's go get the SOBs!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road by herself and confronted the militia alone. Now, that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America, and she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous. It's a song I picked up in West Virginia, written by a fellow named Evans many years ago about that event. The charge on Mother Jones. Now let's see if it's still in my head. Oh, the patriotic troopers come a-marching down the pike, prepared to shoot the miners in the Colorado strike. With whiskey in their bellies and vengeance in their souls, they came prepared to shoot the miners full of holes. In front of those brave troopers loomed, she was less than 5 feet tall, weighed less than 100 pounds. You're going to look loom like that? You better be somebody. In front of those brave troopers loomed a sight you seldom see, a white-haired rebel woman whose age was 83. "Charge!" cried the valiant captain in awful thunderous tones, and the patriotic troopers charged and captured Mother Jones. Oh, it's great to be a trooper with a musket in your hand, prepared to do the dirty work the lords of wealth command. It's great to shoot a miner and hear his dying groans, but there never was such glory as that charge on Mother Jones. There's a rare old song. I'm glad those songs are still out there for people to crawl across the belly of the continent and soak up and put back to work again. Stupid. Stupid is not a condition. Stupid is the name of a person. A person who was so bright that his friends called him stupid as an honorific, like you would call a fat man slim. And he wore the name proudly. Well, he was one of those that had been exiled during the Palmer raids after 1919, exiled from the country, had to flee the country. And I guess he was always afraid to use his real name ever since then, so he wore the name Stoop. But he lived mainly in the public market there in Eugene, Oregon, was cared for by the young people of the town, by the street people. A shrewd, keen mind, a mind like a fog, well, His voice. Someday I'll tell you the story about how Stupid found his voice. That's a whole different story, and I want to wander off into that. You remind me to do that. Stupid, now, lived on a little bit of a rocking chair check. But he would raise $5,000 a year for community causes that had no other source of funding on his own hook. He would put signs in store windows and charge money for it with quaint aphorisms on them. And then he would combine those signs together into little chapbooks and sell them on the street corners. They were called Stupid Sayings About Practically Everything. Some of those sayings made sense and others didn't. One of them, I remember, said, "Never try to teach a pig to sing. You're wasting your time and it annoys the pig." So another one said, "They say make love, not war. Why not get married and do both?" Ha! Well, now, Stupid knew that those little kids in Eugene were going into the public school every day for 5 days a week, and they were standing up in the morning and saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. While they were in class, Stupid would sneak into the schools, and he would thumbtack his Pledge of Allegiance, to the bulletin board on the off chance that some kid would read it and memorize it and stand up in class and say it instead of the other one. Stupid's pledge went, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the multinational corporations and to the profit for which they stand, one interlocking directorate, under no government, indivisible, with monopoly and cheap labor for all." Now, if every kid understood that pledge, they'd know a whole lot, now wouldn't they? Well, Stupid was restoring a filbert orchard owned by the city. He was using street people to do it, using kids. He said, there's enough to go around if we learn how to share it. Well, he was away from the orchard. One of those kids picked some mushrooms, made a mushroom stew. Now, if Stupid had been there, he'd have known better, because those mushrooms were death caps. Took Stupid a long time to die. Yeah. He'd always wanted me to make him a song. So a song about all the things he conscientiously tried to resist in his life. And sometimes he was good at it, and sometimes he failed miserably. They had that wake, lasted all day, sunrise to sunset, and young people, little kids, old people, people of the town came, and everyone stood up one at a time and said what Stupid had meant in their lives, and then sang Stupid's song. "Oh, I have led a good life full of peace and quiet. I shall have an old age full of rum and riot. I have been a good lad, careful and artistic. I shall have an old age coarse and anarchistic. Once I paid my taxes and followed every rule, banker, boss, and bureaucrat thought me a willing tool. I voted Democratic and paid the church its due. Now all those swine will have to find some other chump to screw. Of interest, banks, and credit, insurance, tax, and rent. Of lawyers, agents, generals, and clerics, I repent. With this for corporations and scorn for those elected, oh, I will be an old bum, loved but unrespected." Stupid. Of course, that "with this for corporations" means that that's what we call the mono-digital expletive. You catch my drift. Old Art Nurse lived up in Missoula, Montana. He was from Thompson Falls, north of there. Worked in the forest as a young man. Worked in the underground mines at Butte. Went to sea out of Houston, 20 years on the open sea and then 21 years on the long shore. Very old. Worked to death. He made his way back to Thompson Falls and retired into a little cabin that his kin owned. In his mid-80s, A.L. Art Nurse would always carry his union card, move back down to Missoula, and single-handedly organized a branch of the union of 40 members with an office open 8 hours a day and a, by God, 800 number. Now, if that isn't an organizer, I'd like to know what is. A wobbly hall with an 800 number? Ha! Art Nurse became a great teacher to me. I'd boom over on the freight trains. Yeah, and we would walk together to the old Northern Pacific Railroad yard. He'd use that freight train as a commuter freight. He'd hobble along there and say, "Look at this. This is a non-union railroad. Well, the whole thing had been bought up by Denny Washington, who was a millionaire construction operator, and ran it as the Montana Rail Link, a non-union road. He said, this railroad isn't properly maintained. Look at those spikes standing up there 4 inches. He said, why the county welfare has sued Denny Washington to make up the welfare payments they got to give the tramps who are afraid to ride his trains out of town. Now, he was a true wobbly. A.L. Art Nurse. You know what a true wobbly is? I will tell you, we'll settle this once and for all. It was during an election. Art had come out of the Moose Lodge after having a libation and was taking the corner, holding his hat on against the wind, to open the wobbly office. One of Missoula's morning drunks, they have morning drunks in Montana, one of Missoula's morning drunks reeled out of Charlie's across Higgins Avenue and threw down an old Art Nurse, pulled a loaded pistol, cocked it, pointed at his head, said, are you going to vote Republican or Democrat? Art Nurse said, shoot me. That's a wobbly. Now, Art Nurse had a favorite song, and he said, now, every place you go, I want you to sing this song. I said, damn it, Art, sometimes I get in serious trouble singing this song. He said, doesn't matter. If people know what this song really means, they will also know a whole lot. So, yeah, I'll sing it for you. It also has a refrain in it, but you don't have to sing it. You're under no obligation, but it sure would be great if you were standing there around your radio or standing up in the middle of your living room or wherever you're listening and just shouted out this. This is a song from the McCarthy times when they were trying to destroy the labor movement. Oh, the company's so good to me, there's no more Reds in the union. That's your refrain. I'm respectable as can be, there's no more Reds in the union. My wages, they are up so high, my family's starving, so am I. But sooner than complain, I die, there's no more Reds in the union. I'm paid the lowest wage on earth, there's no more Reds in the union. I'm paid exactly what I'm worth, there's no more Reds in the union. I think the company is fair, they speed me up, but I don't care. My kids complain, but I don't dare, there's no more Reds in the union. We never talk of workers' rights, there's no more Reds in the union. They tell us that it leads to fights, there's no more Reds in the union. Our leaders, they have always said that folks that talk like that are red. So we listen to the boss instead, there's no more Reds in the union. Each year we have a swell affair, there's no more Reds in the union. The bosses and their friends are there, there's no more Reds in the union. They give us food, they give us beer, but one thing does seem mighty queer. We eat that good, but once a year, there's no more Reds in the union. Old Art Nurse. How does that leave us for time there, Steve? Oh, look it. Yeah, it's about 13 minutes or so. Well, let me tell you a story of Jack Miller. I won't put a song with it, but it's something that he told me that had a very, very serious effect on my life. Jack Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center in Seattle. He was another member of the Industrial Workers of the World. Why, he was on the Verona when they took strike relief up to Everett, Washington. They ran a steam-launched Verona, they had leased, and Sheriff McRae raked the deck with gunfire. Why? Because he shouted up the gangplank, who are your leaders here? And they all shouted back, we are all leaders here. He was there when they burned the Bindles, May 1st, 1918, to force the operators to put bunkhouses in the logging camps and to have showers and to have bedding. You carried everything around on your back, your Bindle. By common consent, those booming loggers in the railroad yards, May 1st, 1918, stacked those bindles up, poured kerosene on them, and burned up everything they owned, everything they owned. Jack Miller said, when I started in the forest, we spoke about 15 different languages. We could hardly talk to each other. We had no intellectual life. Most of us couldn't read or write. We lived in our emotions, and we were comfortable there. We were at home there. We made commitments in our emotions to struggle, for which there are no words. And those commitments carried us through 50 or 60 years of struggle. He said, now you show me people who make the same commitments intellectually, and I don't know where they'll be next week. That's worth thinking about. And then he said, you know, armed only with our sense of degradation as human beings, we came together and organized and changed the condition of our lives. And this was the hard thing, he said. You young people, why can't you young people, with all you've got, do the same thing? I want you to ponder that and think about it. Joe Hill. Joel Emanuel Hegeland learned English on the tramp steamers going between Sweden and England. Came with his brother, immigrated to the United States at the turn of the century, changed his name to Joseph Hillstrom. Boomed all over the country doing different kinds of jobs. Of course, when he joined the Industrial Workers of the World, he shortened his name to Joe Hill and wrote songs for the union, wrote beautiful songs that are still sung all over the world, not very much in this country. There are union meetings in Germany and France that open and close with Joe Hill songs, you know. Well, Joe was in the Tijuana Rebellion, an effort to turn Southern California, Baja, into a commune. He was wounded in that, came up to Salt Lake City to recuperate. Well, there was a grocery store operator by the name of Morrison, had been a cop with a reputation for being real heavy with his club. A lot of cons he'd put away in that old Sugar House Penitentiary swore they'd get him when they got out, and somebody did. Well, the governor, Governor Spry, had vowed to bust the IWW, the union, out of the state forever, and that was his excuse. He was able to frame Joe Hill up on the charge of murder. Two phony trials, circumstantial evidence. Joe Hill was convicted and sentenced to die by a firing squad, November 19th, 1915. Well, they couldn't get him out. There were 70,000 letters from all over the world. There was a telegram from President Woodrow Wilson appealing for a new trial, all to no avail. He wrote a letter to Big Bill Haywood at the office in Chicago and said, Bill, don't mourn for me, but organize. Then he said, Bill, when they kill me, I want you to promise you one thing, that you'll take my body over the border into Wyoming because I don't want to get caught dead in Utah. There's a lot of us that feel that way about it, too. Well, it was the day before his execution, Joe wrote one final letter. He said in that letter, imagine this, the day before he was going to be shot. He said, tomorrow, I expect to take a trip to the planet Mars, and if so, we'll immediately commence to organize the Mars Canal workers into the IWW, and we will sing the good old song so loud that the learned stargazers on Earth will once for all get proof positive that the planet Mars really is inhabited. I have nothing to say for myself, only that I have always tried to make the Earth a little better for the great producing class. And I can pass off into the great unknown with the pleasure of knowing that I never in my life double-crossed a man, woman, or child. The day of his execution, he passed a little folded piece of paper out through the bars to a reporter that turned out to be his last will. My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss or moan. Moth does not cling to a rolling stone. My body? Ah, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let some merry breezes blow them to where some flowers grow. Perhaps a fading flower then might come to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, great God, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. Oh, the copper bosses, they framed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I did not die. Says Joe, I did not die. And standing there just as big as life, a-smiling with his eyes, says he what they forgot to kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego on up to Maine and every mine and mill where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Says he, you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. Well, this is Utah Phillips, and you've been listening to Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Juggle of the Mind, where I've just been dithering and talking, and I'm going to do this some more. This makes me feel really good, so let me know if you get along with it, all right? And we'll see you again next week. Spirit bloweth and is still. It will not rise for our whistling nor keep a timetable. No wine that we know can give us anything more than a fugitive caricature of its ecstasies. When it has blown free, we remember it always and know without proof that while the rapture was there, we were not drunk, but wise. That for a moment some intervening darkness had thinned, and we were seeing further than we can see now into the heart of life.
Loafer's Glory is produced at KVMR-FM, Nevada City, with promotion.